Welcome to the ADHD Mums Podcast, a safe place for everyday Australian mums to discuss their struggles with ADHD, motherhood and life. Hello and welcome to the next episode of ADHD Mums. Today we have a very special guest that I've just been acknowledging my fangirlness for, which is Marie Pammon. How are you, Marie?
Good, thanks, Jane. I'm excited to be here. I'm sure anyone who knows me knows I love talking about what we're about to talk about, so I'm excited.
Yes. So I saw Marie speak at the AAPI conference around neurodiversity, and it was by far a highlight for me. Marie's presentation, I thought, was really outstanding, particularly around the way that she talked about herself, interwove her own stories, but then also kept it at a really high level. I was just completely starstruck. And I said to Marie afterwards in an email that I had been kind of sitting in this imposter syndrome around being diagnosed autistic, but then still walking around saying, oh no, I've got some traits, oh no, and then minimizing it. But watching Marie's presentation was the first time that I really saw a lot of myself. And maybe it was because you spoke so well, you were so articulate, but then yet so aware of yourself. I think that was a really interesting mix for me.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's really lovely feedback. And that I think is important. That's why it's important for representation that's really diverse within the autistic community, because there are just so many ways to be autistic. And if we're not seeing lots of representation, then how is anyone going to see themselves reflected in them? So it's lovely to hear that, because that's one of the reasons I decided to be public about being autistic, which was a really scary step for me. So I'm glad it's helping.
I did want to mention one thing that I still talk about to my friends. It was so hilarious. Was when you put up this slide in the beginning and it was like, these are the subjects I'm interested in. Please come and talk to me about. And I was like at soccer with one of my kids recently, and I was thinking, I just want a t-shirt to have that on, because I'm really struggling with all this other stuff that everyone's talking about. Please can we get to a subject that I'm interested in?
Yeah. I put that, I always have that in my presentations now when it's something like that where people don't know me, because I just feel like it's a very autistic culture thing to do. It's like the most people or neurotypicals will be like, here are my achievements and awards, or here's my job or my career stuff, which is great. But for me, I feel like if in an ideal world, if I introduce myself to new people, it's here are the things that I really enjoy and I'm enthusiastic about. And then other people, if they're interested in those things too, usually come up to me and they're like, oh, I love animals or that TV show. And then it's so much less awkward to start a conversation.
Yeah, I loved it. I was like, how can we do that with like t-shirts and have it not be odd? I was like, I just want that on a t-shirt. But anyway, we will move on. So if you don't know who Marie is, this is just a quick overview. She is a neurodivergent clinical psychologist, researcher, and advocate. She works exclusively in the neurodiversity space. Outside of work, Marie loves animals, arts, craft, and music. I love those interests because I feel like that's my whole life. And my daughter, that's all we do, is animals, arts, craft, and music.
Yeah.
Love it. Love it. Okay, so Marie, could you tell us a little bit about your diagnosis story and how you felt about it?
So I pretty much have had an interest in psychology or psychiatry since I was probably 10. It was one of my earliest special interests, other than animals, which was probably my earliest one. But once I was, I don't know, like spending time in the library at lunchtime and things, I was really interested or gravitated towards books about human behavior and things like that, which makes sense now because I was trying to understand everyone around me, I guess. And there'd also been quite a bit of mental health challenges in my family. And I've had my maternal uncle suicided when I was very little, and my grandparents struggle a lot with mental health challenges. So I was exposed to it and I was really curious about it and how this happens and what it means. So I was like reading the DSM when I was 14, I think. Yeah, it would have been like year 8 or something. And I came across Asperger's at the time is what it was in the DSM. And I remember reading it and thinking, oh my gosh, this really sounds like me. So then I went and did some searching on the internet about Asperger's. And what really threw me off the trail was a lot of information online about a lack of empathy and people not being able to have friends. And I did have friends. Looking back, the friendships were probably not typical, but in my mind, I didn't think I had an issue with making friends. And I definitely knew I was very empathetic. So I was like, oh, okay, maybe I just have some traits of this Asperger thing and I don't actually have it. And then I raised it with, I think, the school counselor at the time, and she laughed. She was like, there's no way you have Asperger's. Don't worry about it. Which, problematic response looking back now, but anyway.
Yeah.
And then I had a really significant autistic burnout when I was in high school in year 11. To be honest, building up from about year 10. Year 10, I really started to struggle. I also have ADHD, and that wasn't identified or supported at all. And I would say that probably made school hardest for me. I also have dyscalculia, so math was just a constant source of anxiety, and I'd be reduced to tears frequently in maths class. So school was really hard. And I think in year 10, I kind of hit a bit of a ceiling or a threshold where I just couldn't cope anymore with juggling everything because of ADHD. Math's getting a lot harder. And of course, it's not an elective, so you have to do it. And that was really hard. And then, of course, the social challenges being autistic around year 10, things get really complex, I found, for me anyway, like a lot of the social interactions. Yeah. And I went to an all-girls school.
Oh my God, me too. Sorry.
It was so hard.
Not to me too, the whole thing, but oh my God.
It's really hard. I get along in general. I get along quite well with like gender diverse people or men. I find it really hard to get along with women. Not now that I've met neurodivergent women. It's much easier, but growing up, I really struggled with other girls. And just like things like gossip or like the way that they have cliques or like the social dynamics are really complex, and it just goes right over my head. And I really struggle with that. And things like just being really honest and transparent, but then people take that as you taking a side or throwing shade at someone. And I'm like, oh no, I'm just literally being literal.
Sorry.
Go on.
I totally get it, because it feels like suddenly everybody hates you. But and then I could get all this anxiety, like everybody hates me today and I don't know what I've done. Looking back, I assume I would have been upsetting people. But I actually had no idea. So it felt like it was out of nowhere, which would make it extremely anxiety provoking.
Yeah.
But probably it wasn't out of nowhere.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I see my clients struggle with that now, like the ones that I work with, anyone over the age of 6. So I've got primary school, secondary school, and adult, and then different stages of adulthood, early adulthood, middle adulthood, and older adults. So I see the kind of different challenges people have over the lifespan. And yeah, I think that's a really hard thing when you're a teenager, is it just feels like you can't predict it and you don't know how people are upset, which is very stressful when your intentions were good and you have no idea what's happened. So
exactly.
Yeah, that was really
and
hard.
There's all this expectation around lying. I always, like, someone would go, did they say that about me, or did this happen? And I'd be like, because it did. And I would not understand. I was supposed to lie because then you're loyal to your friend, but you're like, I just was asked a question and I just said yes.
Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly that's a great example. That's something that would happen a lot. And not knowing, kind of, I just couldn't keep up with who had a problem with who, then who I'm supposed to not talk about to someone else. And yeah, it was just very stressful. So that was really difficult. And I ended up having to drop out of school I didn't even start year 12. It was like in the summer holidays between year 11 and year 12. I was so burnt out, and I actually ended up in hospital because of ARFID, like the eating challenges that a lot of autistic people have. I was in a burnout and I just couldn't stomach anything really, and lost a lot of weight, and it was really dangerous medically. And so I ended up in hospital and dropped out of secondary school. And then it took me a few years to recover. from the burnout. And then I went back and finished high school when I was like 22 as an adult, and then did the whole 6-year psych pathway after that. So it was really difficult not being identified or supported. And then again, in my undergraduate degree, we learned a little bit about autism because the DSM-5 had just been published. So they were like, there's been this massive change. It's now autism spectrum, not Asperger's. And again, I just felt I really resonated with it. And I raised it with a psychologist I was seeing at the time, a psychiatrist. And again, she was like, no, there's no way that that's the case. And then there was like a question mark around bipolar, which now looking back, I'm like, that's the ADHD. Yep, that's why you thought I was presenting as hypomanic. I'm very hyperactive. So yeah, there's been a lot of times where I tried to kind of pursue it and hit a barrier, which was usually misinformation or a clinician deterring me. And then it wasn't until I was 30 and working with autistic and ADHD children and feeling like I was looking at me as a kid. And then I was like, no, okay, this is definitely me. And that's when I really, I guess, the doubt that I had always kind of known I was autistic, but I had some doubts. And then that doubt just completely disappeared once I started working with autistic kids. But ADHD, I actually had no idea. At all. Yeah, I had no idea. It was someone else. It was a colleague was like, and you have ADHD. And I'm like, do I? Which is hilarious because I'm so hyperactive.
You are so hyperactive.
Yeah.
You can see that. I mean, and I'm super hyperactive. So I just see a kindred spirit. Yeah.
I just cannot sit still like ever. I can never sit. Yeah. Like I have one of these chairs that I can like wobble on and my legs are constantly moving and my brain never shuts up ever. It's constant.
So I ask, because I find this really fascinating. I don't know if you've watched Sarah Hendrick's videos on YouTube.
No.
Oh, you know what? I went down a rabbit hole and with the whole, anyway, you're probably going to go down this.
Yes, I will.
Anyway, when I was trying to find some examples of autistic women, when I've only been told like 4 times by 3 different psychologists that I should do an autism assessment, but I just went and watched YouTube videos rather than actually addressing it. And Sarah Hendricks did like a master's in autism and she's from the UK and she did so much work within the space, right? Did not know she was autistic at all until she was like 15 years into her career. And I'm paraphrasing, I can't remember exactly the specifics, but it was a long time into her career. And I was just wondering, when you said you were working with autistic children, were you drawn to them? Like you obviously didn't know you're autistic then. So how did that happen?
What's really interesting is I have always been drawn towards autism. So pretty much once I learned about it when I was around 14 and read about it in the DSM and then went and did a deep dive in it, I have just been interested in it since then. So that would have been like 2004. And then I was really active online a lot as a teenager. A lot of my socializing happened in back then online forum, which was like Facebook groups or Discord servers now, I guess. So I happened upon many people diagnosed with Asperger's who were open about that. And I seemed to really get along with them. So I've always been interested in it. And then when I was in my undergraduate degree, I knew that it was really competitive to get into postgraduate. So I wanted some practical experience. And so I did look into being an ABA therapist,
which would not kind of have suited you. Now I know you better. Yeah. Okay. The definition of ABA is applied behavioral analysis.
Yeah. I'm very passionately against it. And at the time I had no idea about it other than and this in itself is very concerning to me as a psychologist. It's the only thing you can access as a student in terms of there's a lot of safeguarding around vulnerable populations. So you can't get any experience except with autistic kids. And that is really scary to me. Like that should not be the case because they are an incredibly vulnerable population. And it's really bizarre to me that you can be an undergraduate student and do therapy on a child who's autistic. So anyway, I didn't actually end up pursuing it because in the trial, shift that I had, where it was like to see if I would, I suppose, bond with the child, or the child responded to me, or whatever engagement. I naturally fell into parallel play with this child. So he didn't look at me and sat parallel to me. And I just started making something like next to him. And we were both having a great time. But then the parents commented that, oh, no, this isn't going to be a good fit because you're not getting him to interact with you. And I remember thinking to myself, we are interacting, obviously not in a typical way. Now I know what they were looking for. But so they took the kind of the toy away from him, and he had a meltdown, and it just sat so badly with me. I felt really yuck inside when I saw that. And I was like, oh, I don't think I could do this, actually. This is really uncomfortable. So, yeah.
Interesting. I actually got, my kids are on the NDIS. I have three children on the NDIS, and I had an ABA therapist call me, and we didn't, it got heated on the phone. The first thing she said to me, and I know that this isn't all ABA therapists, so I know that it's changing, and I understand that people DM me about that all the time, because I released an episode today about the NDIS and the PBS program, which is a positive behavioral support program, and how if you do have a practitioner in your home and you're not, you know, you're not in the psychology industry, or you don't know a lot about it, and you don't feel right with what is being said or done with your children, or it's not right for you, feel free to push back, because you as the mother are the expert on your child.
Yes.
And you don't want to go with something regardless of what it is, because you're told that you have to. Yeah. So anyway, segue. But I love what you're saying about that. That's so interesting. So you're already working with the population when you realized you could be. Did you seek your own assessment, or did you someone approach you? How did that work?
Sorry, I didn't even answer your question. So once I started working as a psychologist, I didn't intentionally go into autism. It just so happened that the clinic that I worked at saw a lot of autistic children. And I think as a new grad, I think this happens in a lot of places. They give you the children that they find difficult. They kind of palm them off to you when you're a new grad. And I didn't find those children difficult. So I was seeing a lot of, like, in the handover notes about that they're really difficult to engage with. So this will be a really good learning experience for you. And then I found I was engaging with them in the first session. So it was, that's how I ended up really loving working with autistic people. And then over a few years, just, I think, naturally kind of selected out neurotypical people. Just wasn't a good fit, I don't think, for me personally. I know there are lots of autistic psychologists who do work with non-autistic people and they find that fine, but I think my particular approach or communication style probably just doesn't really fit. And masking, although I can do it pretty well for an hour, I just don't think it gets results for me personally. Like, the progress would be very slow because it's not an authentic connection. That's just my experience. I know other people are fine with that, but I find it really hard to build rapport if I'm masking.
Yeah, I think as well, I love the fact there's so many autistic psychologists around, neuroaffirming people who have lived it, particularly with children. Like, I always try and find a neuroaffirming psychologist or a therapist that's neurodiverse if I can, if they disclose it, or if I pick it up, or if they have their own autistic children, you know that they at least understand, or, you know, it's genetic. So I think it's great that you're in that space.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun too.
So that would be one of the reasons why you've ended up in assessment and research, I would assume.
Yeah, that's how I ended up in assessment and therapy. And then research came only about, 2 years into my PhD, but I'm doing it part-time, so it's going to be a long haul. That came from sheer frustration working as an autistic psychologist with autistic people. And then my PhD project is on stimming. So these, like, repetitive regulating behaviors that autistic people have. I was seeing a lot of the kids that I work with, their teachers having goals for them around keeping their body still and not stimming during class. And I was saying, well, that's not actually helpful. And even working with other allied health professionals, sometimes there would be like an OT or a speech pathologist or a pediatrician who also would challenge me on that and say, oh, no, but that's disruptive behavior. We need, that needs to be a goal. And I would push back on that. But then what I would hear was, well, where's the evidence for that then? Mm. And so I just got to a point where I got so frustrated and passionate about it that I was like, well, fine, I will do a PhD then. That's how that happened.
I love it. I just think it so needs to happen. I've got three kids and the classroom is always a bone of contention at the moment. And I'm hoping in 10 years' time that will be different with people like yourself in that space. Even though I feel like there's so much talk around labeling now and the benefits. And the reason I use the word label is because that's what other people say. They'll go, I don't want to label my kid. And that's what I'll hear. Even where I go, let's say soccer training, I'll always hear someone talk about ADHD medication, or they'll go, oh, I don't want to label my kid. And it just seems to be the words that are still out there. What are the benefits? And I know that labeling isn't the right word, but what are some of the benefits around diagnosis?
Yeah, I'm going to share with you, I don't know if you can share this with your viewers, but I co-authored a piece for The Conversation with Josie Barbro, who's an associate professor at La Trobe, I believe now is openly autistic and ADHD, and she does a lot of research on early identification. So we actually have an app in Australia that you can get on, I think, any smartphone called AS Detect. And if your child is, I think, in the first year or 18 months or, oh, I can't remember the exact age range, but it's very little, it's babies. You can download this app for free and it will tell you if your child is likely autistic. It's not diagnostic, but it's meant to be like a, hey, go and see a pediatrician or something about this. So she's really passionate about early identification. And obviously I then also work with teenagers and adults. So we put those knowledge areas together and wrote this piece about when you should talk to your child about autism if they've been diagnosed. Because yes, this is a big concern that parents have. Understandably, parents want to protect their children. And once you tell them they're autistic, you can't really take that back. So I understand there's concern around when and how you tell them. But I think, firstly, it's always a case-by-case basis. But as a general rule, there tend to be more benefits of telling children than withholding it from them. And one of the things that a lot of autistic people say, both in research and in out online and in the world, in the community, is that other kids know they're different and they know they're different. So whether you give them the language for it or not, they feel different and they're treated different. And that's really hard. So if you have the language for something, we can get ahead of, I suppose, the discrimination they're going to face anyway, because that's the reality. And it's a bit more empowering to have the information and to know that, oh, okay, maybe people sometimes will be nasty to me because they pick up that I'm different from them. But we arm them with the narrative and we get to help them have their own narrative. It's not going to be this narrative that comes from society about you're weird and we don't want to be friends with you, or whatever it is, this is why you struggle. And instead, we get to shape that narrative with them and we can make it neutral and realistic and affirming, not superpower either, because that's also not helpful. But, you know, that really neutral kind of realistic middle ground of, yes, you are different. And there will be things that will be hard about that. And there are things that are great about that.
Oh, yeah, I love that. My daughter is 8 and we disclosed diagnosis to her, I think it was in December, just before she hit grade 3. Mm-hmm. And I was so glad I did, because there's a big jump at her school and they start to transition to high school at grade 3. I personally have a problem with that. But anyway, that's what they do. And what do you know? She couldn't cope. And she really, really struggled. And it got to the point where we pulled her out of school. And she said to me in bed one night, why is it that I can't cope and everyone else can? And now I can't see my friends. And it made that conversation so much easier, because we'd already had that conversation. So we kind of got in before the crisis. So she understood the reasons why. And I think she makes better decisions now because she understands that she shouldn't, well, she doesn't want to just go along with what everyone else is doing because she actually knows it doesn't feel good.
Yeah. That's so important, hey. And there are other concerns people have, and I see it in clinical practice too, is sometimes I have these conversations with parents and with the child all together, and then me and the child one-on-one, so they can tell me things they might be like nervous to say in front of their parent around, okay, you have this information, who do you tell? That's a really important conversation to have because it can potentially be unsafe for them to disclose that they are autistic, especially if other kids don't respond the way we'd like them to and start to use that against them and tease them or use it as a slur or whatever. Like that stuff can happen. So it's not super black and white. Like there's a lot of nuance around helping them know what to do with that information. But it is so important for them to know about their brain and how it works and what it needs. So I think in any case, like regardless of whether people label it autism or not, for me, the most important thing is that they are told how, like, that their brain is different and that they are guided and supported to learn about what they need and what's hard for them, regardless of if we label it or not. That is essential, definitely.
Yeah, I agree. And I would like to believe that because I have similar experience with a massive autistic burnout, worse than I've ever had as an adult, as a kid. I was about 14. I noticed in your presentation you had the slide around the transition from grade 6 to 7, and I was like, oh my God, I've never seen
so
it
hard.
So and anyway, but I hope by disclosing, my daughter will make better decisions and we can make better decisions for her moving forward, because I think that's autistic burnout when you don't know that you're in it and no one knows what's going on as a kid. It's very confusing.
Yeah, it is. And if you don't have the language, the most logical explanation is there's something wrong with me or there's something broken in my brain. Like I believed that for most of my life. I was like, there's something really, really not right about me. I just don't fit anywhere. Nothing is easy for me like it is for other people. Or actually, I should reframe that. There's a lot that's easy for me, just not typical stuff.
Like, I remember, going on the dial-up internet when I was young. And the first thing I searched in my experience of internet, right, I think I was 14. We got like proper internet at home when I was about 14. And you have the, you know, shh,
no
one can use the phone.
And it took like
and all
5 minutes.
And so you've really got to be determined to get that page up, right? Because if you re-click it, it'll refresh. It'll take another 5 minutes. And for ADHD, it's really hard to wait, right?
Oh, God, yes.
And I remember the first thing that I typed in was bipolar disorder.
Wow.
And I diagnosed myself with that, printed it out on our slow printer, and then I looked up epilepsy because I was experiencing shutdowns, but I didn't know what they were, and I thought I had epilepsy.
Mm.
So people think that kids don't know, but they know.
They know.
Exactly.
Yeah, they know. I've even had kids who are diagnosed and their parents haven't told them. And so I'm seeing them to support them. And whilst I'm working with the parents to unpack their kind of concerns or reasoning around not disclosing, the child in a one-on-one session will say to me, I've found videos on YouTube about autism. I'm pretty sure I've got it. Can you tell my parents?
Oh,
and I'm
my
sitting
God.
There going, and they're like 12 and 13 and they've worked it out themselves. And that makes it so much easier. Then I just go to the parents and I'm like, look, they've worked it out. I haven't confirmed it. But what do you want to do?
Do they agree then at that point? I mean, if the kid's 99% there, do they
say? Usually at that point they do. Their concern was more how their child was going to respond. But I guess once your child has figured it out for themselves and are clearly wanting the answer, that makes things a bit easier.
Okay,
it's
wow.
Interesting though. Kids work out, and especially now with access to things like YouTube and TikTok, and I'm convinced the algorithm can detect who's neurodivergent. It's got to, because I'm even with adults I'm assessing, they're like out of nowhere, they start using TikTok or something for the first time. And all of a sudden, all the content is about autism and ADHD when they've had no interest in that before. It's got to know. I don't know.
Yeah, I agree. I saw someone online the other day and they were like, oh, there's ADHD everywhere. Every video I look at is about ADHD. And someone commented and put, my algorithm doesn't do that. You might need to get assessed. And I was like, oh
Yeah.
My God.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so part of the assessment criteria, I get DMs all the time about, for example, I had a mum this morning DM me and she said, I've waited 3 years for a pediatrician appointment through the public system. And I was told it wasn't because of eye contact, blah, 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 or lack of empathy, one of the old things. And I was wondering, what do you think the most tricky areas are that mums need to get prepared on for their kids, but also for themselves?
Yeah, for themselves too. Yeah. I think so. The trickiest part of the barriers to assessment and diagnosis are if people have an internalized presentation or if they mask or both. And those are different things. So I'm really glad I have an opportunity to talk about this because I think this is missing a bit in some of the information out there. A lot of people are talking about masking being a barrier to being identified, which it absolutely is. But there are also plenty of people who don't mask who aren't getting diagnosed. So it's not the only barrier. And I think there's also this group of autistic people who they don't mask, but they are internalized. So for example, if they are overwhelmed, they're more likely to kind of shut down or withdraw, which doesn't really look, I suppose, autistic to other people. They might just see them as like shy or anxious or introverted, as opposed to people who have meltdowns or things that are really external and observable as not being typical. So yeah, I think it's not just about masking. It's also about how your traits kind of present and if they are really observable or not so much, or they look like they could be shyness or attachment difficulties or whatever other trauma, whatever other things people are explaining it as. So that's usually the challenge, is not presenting in a way that's really commonly observed or stereotypical. I think another challenge though, which is really out of your hands as a client, is whether the person you're seeing, like the pediatrician or the psych or whatever, whether they have up-to-date knowledge or their own biases around autism. So I have met, for example, many other health professionals who believe autism is overdiagnosed, even though there's no evidence for that. That's just a belief that they have, and they've not gone and read the papers and the rationale for why that's not the case. So they're going to have quite a different idea of what the threshold for diagnosis is. I think it's going to be a lot higher. And then also just gender bias. So I've had, for example, girls that I've diagnosed who have had an assessment before and had autism ruled out, and they're not even masking. And actually their traits are really stereotypical as well. Like they really love trains and aeroplanes and dinosaurs. So they don't have, I suppose, the, like people talking about how sometimes autistic girls have really interests that on the surface look typical, like fairies or mermaids or animals and arts and crafts, which yes, plenty of us do, but interests aren't really gendered. There are also boys who like fairies and mermaids and whatever, and there are also girls who love trains and dinosaurs and space and planets and things. And yeah, and I'm just seeing these girls who have those really stereotypical interests. They don't make eye contact, they don't talk about emotions, and they're still not getting diagnosed. And the only explanation I can find for that is it's got to be the assessor's own bias that like this little girl with like pigtails who's wearing pink couldn't possibly be autistic. And yeah, I don't know how you prepare for that other than just be aware that that exists out there in health professionals. And so if someone's not listening to your concerns or your observations about your child, seek a second opinion, which is unfair because it's money and time that people probably don't have. And I'm just really sorry that that's the reality we currently live in.
Yeah, it's sad that it's such a privilege. You've got to have a parent with time and money if you're a child. And also, if you're an internalizer autistic person, then maybe you need to have a pretty forthright parent too that's going to go to the second opinion, because if the parent goes and they rule it out, well, it's really not the parent's fault. It's a really hard one.
It is. I would say actually that maybe one way that we could be prepared is focusing a lot on the more stereotypical criteria and how your child does have those, I think, or yourself, because I think that in itself is kind of like preempting that even if someone does have a narrow view of autism, you actually also have evidence for that narrow view. So it could be things like just saying to them, I know that she is making eye contact with you right now, or he is making eye contact with you right now, and answering your questions. But usually after an appointment like this, when we're in the car, they will ask me what you meant by XYZ, or they will, on the way here, they were asking me, what is this person going to ask me? What should I say back? Like, any evidence you have that they're not understanding some social situations, I think can really help being prepared with some evidence of
That's a great point. Like, starting off with the things that are the, I suppose, hitting the exact criteria, starting there, not starting with things that might not be generically accepted, possibly. That's a really good point, actually. And I think the expectation from the parent, and I mean, I understand why, is that you think that the practitioner is going to problem solve it with you. But actually, sometimes the psychiatrist or pediatrician, whoever it is, psychologist, actually just tells you the questions that you've already read. And then you answer them and you're thinking that they're going to tease it out with you.
They don't.
But that doesn't always happen.
Yeah. Many people don't tease that out. And I just say that as a neutral kind of statement. I don't blame anyone. I think there's a real lack of education around assessment, even as a professional. We barely touched on it in 6 years of study that I had to do to become a clinical psychologist. And all of my knowledge, pretty much most of it, has come from my own professional development that I have sought out and paid for and invested in, which some people can't afford or don't have the time to do. So I think there is a real lack of information around autism amongst health professionals, which is like a systemic problem. Yeah.
And then I think it's pretty sad that the parent possibly has ADHD. So being prepared and putting that time aside and getting organized might be a really difficult thing to do. Yeah. Also, as a mother, I can tell you I'd rather do anything else than think about my child's deficits.
Yeah.
Because what you see is what you see. So if I go and spend 2 hours thinking about all the things my child can't do, then I'm not feeling really positive towards them later on. So it's not something that you want to do either. It's not fun. So I can see why people don't get prepared.
Yeah, very true. And I don't know if it's helpful for anyone, if you are kind of dreading that, thinking about the challenges your child is having, if it's helpful, you could frame it in your mind as, what are the things my child is really struggling with that's causing them anxiety and stress and distress? Because those are the things they're going to need support with. So rather than saying, here's all the stuff my child is really bad at, it's more, here's the stuff that my child finds really stressful because it's inaccessible for them. And those are the things that we can support them with.
Yeah, true.
I don't know if that helps, but because it is awful to think about, and even as an adult, here's all the things I'm really bad at. And I'm not actually bad at them. They're hard because they're inaccessible. Yeah.
No, I totally agree. And that then you're accessing help. It's a hard road, to be honest.
Yeah.
I've found it really draining and depressing to say that. So what things would you suggest mums do if they were bringing, and I say daughter, but I mean like internalizing really to an assessment?
Yeah. So I think, as I just mentioned, I think the most important thing is being prepared with things. And I would say written down if you can, because one thing that can be really hard if another health professional, you feel like they're not listening or they're pushing back. I don't know about other people, but myself and a lot of my clients actually tend to then shut down and not know how to push back or set boundaries or be assertive. So if you've got it in front of you, it can be a bit easier to prompt you to be like, okay, actually, I'm going to keep going telling you about these things, or would you like to read it? I've prepared it earlier. So I think, yeah, and the things that you would be writing down are the things that you think are probably the most significant challenges for them at this point in time, just so you can be like concise. If you don't get much time with the health professional, you can distill it down to the things that are the hardest right now, or perhaps the most well-known autistic traits or ADHD traits, so that if we're worried about the assessor having any kind of bias, they're not going to write you off in the first 30 seconds when you start talking about your child lacking fairies. Maybe start with something like, they really struggle meeting new people and don't know what to say and ask me for scripts in the car. That might be something to still, or sensory sensitivities is also a really well-known part of being autistic. So even starting there with their sensory aversions and challenges at the moment. So I think that is one thing I would say. The other thing would be thinking about if you can get someone to come with you. If you are someone who tends to shut down, do you have a trusted friend or a partner or a family member who you can go before you go in, just say, my goal for this appointment is for them to say, yes, we should pursue an assessment. Can you make sure I get that point across? Or if I shut down, can you jump in and try and get us there? That can be helpful too.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. I think that's a great point, actually. Okay, in terms of mothers, it's a really interesting space because I have brought into the podcast a number of autistic women who are mums, who are just regular Aussie mums who just share their experience. And it's so enlightening because I think for a lot of us, myself included, I've never really spoken to somebody about what their life is like being autistic and being a mum, because we know it's loud, it's crowded, there's lots of touching. How does it play out? And I was wondering, with all the women that you've seen, what are some of the things you've seen that mothers say happens that we might not know about?
I'm really fascinated by this complete gap in our understanding of the autistic experience, as in the experiences of mums or autistic parents in general. Like there's really not much out there. I think, yeah, we're at a point in time where, yeah, we're identifying autism a lot better now, but it means we've got adults who are unidentified or late identified. So we actually don't have research on being an autistic parent. And I say that because like there's a little bit out there, but really not much. And I say that as someone who is very risk averse and anxious about new experiences, I wanted to understand better because I'm planning to be a mom. So I'm like, I want to know what to expect from the pregnancy, from the birth, from the first few years, then what are the hard things later? And I just couldn't find much at all, which is terrifying. So I had to go and look online at groups and social media content creators who are autistic moms to learn directly from community, because I'm like, there's no other information available. So yeah, it's a huge gap area. But one thing I have seen a lot in my own practice is that can be really hard is competing needs between parent and child, where, for example, if the parent is one who expresses and receives love a lot through touch and physical affection, but their child is very touch averse and doesn't like to be touched and doesn't like hugs, that can be really difficult for parents to process and make sense of or feel connected to their child. And then the other way around as well. So I've seen parents who are very touch averse, but their child is really sensory seeking and wants to like pinch or squish or hug and touch a lot. And parents are like crawling out of their skin, just, oh my God, stop touching me. And then auditory differences as well. So if either the parent or the child likes to make a lot of noise or seek in that way, but the other one is very overwhelmed by noise. So yeah, I think that competing needs is a challenge that I see come up a lot. And the other one, honestly, is society and how everyone has a lot to say about your parenting.
Yeah.
And I had that experience as a child. My mum was naturally affirming, so she had no idea that she was autistic. She had no idea that I was autistic, and just naturally understood me and attuned to me and let me pursue my interests and dim and live my authentic autistic life. But I remember a lot of my friends' parents had a lot to say about how my mom chose to parent me, and definitely psychologists that I saw when I was a teenager and I was really struggling at school had a lot to say about, I believe the term was enmeshment. So basically my mom and I didn't have good boundaries and we were too involved in each other's lives. But looking back now, I'm like, my mom was my support person. Mm. Of course, she was going to come with me to the places and new things when there's no way I could have accessed it without a support person there. So yeah, I think that can be really, and I see that's really hard for the parents that I work with as well, is so much negative feedback when they are parenting in a way that I think, according to the research and my clinical experience, is good parenting. They're getting a lot of negative feedback for that. And that's really hard.
Yeah, it's interesting. I do hear that a lot, and I hear parents say or mums say, but they're the expert and they told me. And my response is always, but who's the expert on your child? Exactly. They're the expert in medication or whatever is their area. And yeah, you should work together, but one brain is not going to cut it. Like, you need to have the expert of the child, which is the mother or the father,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and then the expert of the field working together. Absolutely. 50-50. That's my thought pattern on it. We're not going to, I totally agree with you.
Yeah,
because we 100%. Know our kids. Yeah. And your mum and you. So.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And even as the experts in the field, we like research, for example, is only one form of evidence. And the reason for that is because the research has gaps in it and maybe hasn't been done on someone exactly like that child. Either the demographics are different or the circumstances and the context is different. So there actually isn't research that is 100% applicable to any individual. Our job as professionals is to apply the research where it applies, but then use our own judgment and experience and the client's actual expertise and lived experience and values and their own goals for themselves and marry all those things up. And that's where our skill comes in. So that's best practice. That's what we should be doing. That's the triad of evidence-based practice: science or research, clinician expertise, and the client lived experience and goals or values. Wow. That's what it's supposed to be.
I love that. So it's gone are the days of the old white men making decisions for everybody in their suits with no lived experience of anything. I love that. Mm. That's actually great. I was going to ask you, do you think that ADHD or the autistic experience can be cumulative? So a lot of women will describe being diagnosed after having children, but then there's this question that I don't know if anyone really knows the answer to. Because is it because the children are picked up at school and they're going to be diagnosed? Or, and there's a lot of women who say that that actually hasn't happened for them, it's been this huge cumulative load that has then led to a diagnosis.
Yeah, yeah, there is. You're absolutely, everyone's onto something there. So if this is helpful for people, the framework that would fall under is called the social model of disability. And specifically something called person environment fit, which is your personal traits, challenges, strengths, and how they fit with the demands of your environment.
I'm going to look this up. That sounds amazing.
Yeah. So it comes from sociology, and psychology has now started to use this a lot in research as well, which is great. And this is why I think fields should be talking to one another. But anyway, it's this idea that neurodivergence in itself is not the problem. Like, there's no kind of pathology that we've found or something wrong in the brain. Where disability comes from is a mismatch between someone's traits and the demands of their environment. I like to give like an example that's really concrete for people, that I work in a field where I have flexible work hours. and it's my special interest, and it's very clear what the boundaries and expectations are in social interaction in my job, right? So that fits me really well. I get to talk about something that I'm very interested in. I get to help people with something that I have lots of knowledge about. And it's always very clear that for 50 minutes to an hour, I am going to interact with them in a way where the expectations are clear. That is very different to if I were working in hospitality, where it's unpredictable. There's lots of small talk. I don't know who's going to try to talk to me, what they're going to try and talk about. There's lots of noise. There's lots of multitasking. I would absolutely be fired within a few days if I worked in hospitality. Now, I'm the exact same person, but in those two contexts, my functioning would be completely different. So I think that's person environment fit within the social model of disability. So basically what's happening when people have children is the demands increase, because now you're not just trying to get through life as a single person or a couple. You've now got children that you have to manage and organize and plan, which if you have ADHD is a whole lot of executive function. So that's hard. And if you're autistic, then those kids also come with sensory demands and social demands. One thing I don't know how parents do, and I'm really dreading it, is going to like school pick up and drop offs and birthday parties.
That spurred on my diagnosis, Marie. That was actually what did it, when I had to walk into prep every day and you had to get them from the classroom. There was always that 5-minute period where everyone had to stand around and talk before and after, and it happened all year.
Oh, God.
And I just was like, how the fuck do people do this? I went to a netball carnival on Sunday, and it was like 6 hours of netball. Now, I love netball. It's a special intro. I'm obsessed with it, right? Mm-hmm. But the amount of small talk and people that spoke to me about the weather and all this boring shit while we were watching it, and it went for so long. I was like, oh, I can't do this any longer.
Mm. Yeah.
Yes. That model, and I can't wait to read about it. That's amazing. Yeah.
And I really struggle with, I guess, the ADHD, like the impulsivity. The reason I think it would be really hard for me is if people start gossiping. Like, I'm not around that. My friends don't do that, and my family don't do that. And I find it really hard to be around that, because I literally can't not say something, where if people are gossiping about someone else and they ask me for my input, I find it really hard to kind of agree or just nod and smile. And I'm likely to say something like, well, I don't have their side of the story, so I don't know.
And that's going to really annoy people.
Like,
you know, I always defend the person who's getting gossiped about. And you know what? Yeah. No one wants to gossip with me anymore.
Well, that's great. Maybe it'll work in my favor. Eventually.
Yeah, it's a quick way, because you're like, oh, but you know, if you think about it from their perspective, and then everyone just moves away and you're like, yeah, oh, job done.
I love this. Thank you for this wisdom.
Okay, so you answered the cumulative question really well. I'm going to put a link in to that social model of disability. I'm only going to add one thing, because I love that. I'm very excited about that. That's going to be my whole afternoon, Marie. But it's kind of like when you have children, you're trying to figure out where they fit. And because the environment that they're in, i.e. school, doesn't always suit them, but where can they go? And it's this constant mismatch, which I find really difficult, because each child is different, each environment's different. But then you also need to work, live, you want to be away from your children sometimes, and you also need them to be independent. So then how, I can't wait to read that, because actually I think my 8-year-old daughter, who's probably going to go into psychology with the questions she asked me, will be interested in that, because she wants to understand why the world is good for some people and not for others.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the really, oh, bless. That's big questions for an 8-year-old to be asking, isn't it? But they're so curious.
Well, she actually really handles it well. Something about kids, you work with kids where they're like, yep, they don't, okay, got it.
Yeah.
Okay, it's some heavy stuff, but she's handling it apparently. Yeah. she's a funny one. Okay, so Do you have an overarching message for a mum that's just being diagnosed or a woman in this space, something that you'd like to share the message of, but you don't get asked or you don't get the opportunity to say much?
Yeah, you're the expert in your child. I think we've covered that, but that is absolutely a take-home message. If something doesn't sit right for you or feel right for you, be curious with the health professional and ask them if they can explain the reasoning behind what they're doing or try and help you understand it a bit better. And then if their explanation still doesn't really sit right for you, I think trust that gut instinct. And in general, I would say what I want, especially neurodivergent people, to really accept or embrace is to trust your instincts. So I think a lot of minority communities experience this, not just autistic or ADHD people, but lots of cultural minorities and the queer community as well, is the majority are viewing things from their perspective. And so even if when they have good intentions, a lot of the things that they suggest or that they think are the right thing to do is based on their culture and their norms. And I think what that does over time is it erodes our sense of what is right for our culture and our norms and our families. And it starts to create doubt in your own experience. And okay, for example, growing up having sensory sensitivities and hearing from other people that you're being oversensitive and that doesn't smell that bad or that's not that loud, over time you start to not trust your body anymore and you're like, oh, maybe that isn't that loud, or maybe I am overreacting. And that's a really dangerous place to be, because our bodies and brains need to do this to survive. They need to tell us and give us cues that something isn't right or isn't working. So I think getting back to a place where you're in tune with your instincts and with your body and listen to it and trust it. It knows, and your brain knows. And yeah, and that, trying to dig that doubt out and get rid of it.
That's such a huge, I love that. That's amazing. One of the things that makes me think about is I had someone on here last week, and she was saying that as a kid, exactly what you were talking about, she was taught or told she was wrong or not to trust herself or whatever it was. And then she ended up getting into a series of relationships or situations that were traumatizing for her because she didn't trust her instinct. That's such an important message when you put it like that, because that's pretty much what she was saying as to why, when she felt things weren't right, she didn't trust herself.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. I see it happen so much with friends, family, clients, colleagues who are autistic and have really feel something doesn't sit well with them, or they've been trying to tell people that something feels not right about a situation or in their bodies, and they're not listened to or believed. And then it turns out that, like, they have this medical condition that no one has found because no one was listening about the pain they've been experiencing, or putting it down to, oh, that's just a sensory sensitivity, or maybe your interoception is too sensitive or whatever. So I think if something really feels like it's the right decision and other people are saying don't do that, if it feels right for you, that's the right decision. And then vice versa, if something feels really wrong or uncomfortable or it's setting off some kind of alarm in your brain, be curious about that. Don't just dismiss it if other people disagree or don't listen or validate you.
Oh, that's such a great message, Marie. Thank you so much for your time. This has just been, it's like one of those ones I'm going to re-listen to, like when it's not even edited. Like, I'll just kind of like drive around and be like, I'm just going to listen to my folder of unedited content. Thank you so much for your generosity. I'm going to leave all of Marie's details in the show notes. If you'd like to contact her, obviously don't DM her constantly. I don't think you answer anyway, but if you want to read more about her or any of her work, I will leave her website on the show notes.
Thanks for having me, Jane. That was so much fun.
The key message here is you are not alone.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, follow us on Instagram or head over and join our amazing ADHD Mums podcast Facebook community. Everything you do matters and helps to spread the word about what neurodiversity in females looks like.